Hello, everyone, and welcome to season 3 of Everything is Gay, Even the Straight Stuff. We're here, we're queer, you're used to it. My name is John McDonald. I'm a queer playwright living in America currently. And today's film that we're going to talk about to kick off season 3 is by request of my beautiful co-host, Magnus. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, Magnus?
Hello, everybody. Hey, I'm Magnus L. Alexander. I'm an English author and comic book writer, and I suppose general dog's body as well, sort of doing all the odds and bits ends I need to do.
And I think you're being very bashful, because when you do your Kickstarters for your comics, they often go over funding, which is really neat, because not every comic book person gets that, so...
Oh no, I'm very grateful for everyone's support and faith in what I do, which always encourages me to go above and beyond what I'm doing, even if it ends up with myself running around like a headless chicken sometimes. But it's all good. It's all good.
All good. Yeah. Well, everything is not all good in the movie we're talking about today. There's some really good stuff. It's a very bittersweet story. It's still a very heart-wrenching story in a lot of ways. It came from a 13-page short novella by, and I can never pronounce her name, so I'm sure I'm getting this wrong, Annie Proulx. I don't know if the X, how we're supposed to say the X, but however you're supposed to say the name. It was a 13-page novella that was made into a film by Ang Lee. It's not my favorite of Ang Lee's films, and it's probably not his most well-known, but I think it's probably his best. We can talk about that as we talk over the film, but what made you want to bring Brokeback Mountain to our first podcast episode for season 3? What makes it Everything is Gay, other than the obvious of the leads being gay?
Besides the entire film being drenched in gayness.
It's true.
I suppose I chose this one because I felt, as we were starting the third season in February, and it's the month of romance, apparently. For me and my partner, we show our affection to each other around the entire year. So I don't know, we don't generally celebrate the 14th of February, because we're kind of constantly doing things for each other anyway. But beyond that, because it was still in February, I thought it might be nice to choose something that was quite impactful for mainstream cinema and queer cinema at the same time. And I think we have mentioned Brokeback a few times in connection to a few other things, haven't we?
Yeah, this film is definitely one of the films that, when people dialogue about the advance in queer cinema, Brokeback is kind of like the start of 2005 and beyond. So it's the start of things that would allow later for things like Love, Simon, probably I'd say Moonlight. There aren't many other queer country epics. I think probably the most recent queer country epic explicitly is the Benedict Cumberbatch Power of the Dog one, and I don't know if that has some of the themes in it are questionably redemptive to the queer experience. It's interesting because there's a lot of revision of cowboy mythology and noting the queerness of the cowboys, but generally cowboy films are seen as a standard of masculinity. If there's queerness in it, it's full of camp, like in Johnny Guitar, which is sort of the queer cowboy standard for me. So it's an interesting film. It's interesting too in that it's kind of the height of Ang Lee's career, and he's probably the only one I could think of off the top of my head. He's probably one of the only internationally well-known Taiwanese directors as well. And so this was quite a coup when this came out in 2005. There was a lot of buzz for this film. Ang Lee was riding high off of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, And so it was kind of right place, right time, right script, right actors. Even the screenwriters were well chosen for it. So,
definitely. Yeah, I just touching upon a point you made before. You were saying about how it opened the door for a lot of other queer films to be made. I'd argue that it wasn't just country esque films that were being done. I think films like Milk, Pride, films of a variety of genres, the success of Brokeback really helped show Hollywood financiers that, you know what, there might be something here to these films. And sadly, that's a very commercial way of viewing it, of viewing art. But if it helped people to bring their stories to the big screen, then, you know, it had a good impact then from that side of things. Sorry, I interrupted. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to go off on a tangent, or not really a tangent. It was apropos, but you said and I want to hear the rest of your thoughts. So, yeah.
I was going to comment about the actors, actually. Was that related to what you were going to say?
One of the things I brought up, I have the, not IMDb, but I have like the Google, here she was in the movie page up. And I saw this movie recently and I hadn't realized all the actors, many of whom are still very bankable and very Hollywood for kind of the leads of this film, which is really neat.
Yes, I was going away from the gorgeous men of the film for a second. Anne Hathaway, I have to admit, I'd completely forgotten that she was in this film until I reminded myself about it. And I've always been a big fan of what she's done.
Yeah.
But she was definitely one of the leading young starlights of her generation and is still very well regarded to this day. And when we talk about the men, I mean, this was 4 years after Donnie Darko, a year after, what was that fame? Edge of Tomorrow, was it? No. What was the disaster film that Jake Gyllenhaal starred in? The year before this.
I can't remember. He's done a lot of work. For our listeners, they can be angered at Slater for not knowing Jake Gyllenhaal's entire filmography, but he's done a lot of good work. So you can pardon us for not knowing it off the top of our head.
But the thing, my point is, like, this was very soon, really, after Jake's like breakout stardom and Donnie Darko, and Heath Ledger was riding high as well. And for both of them to sign up for what really, I suppose, was a big passion project. It was quite something, wasn't it?
I can't remember at the time. I remember during promotions for this film, there were a lot of questions about both of their sexualities, and people still ask Jake Gyllenhaal if he's gay because of Brokeback. In fact, people tend to Photoshop him with like gay cowboy shirts on. So I don't know in casting how it went. I know they were both very intense about making sure the story was right. What's interesting about this film is that it almost shouldn't work because even in the Wikipedia page for Ang Lee, when it talks about his work in Brokeback, he was a little displaced from it because he doesn't really identify as queer. And so Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger really drove this story. What's interesting too is that one of the other things that shouldn't work, and the thing that kind of tanked Ang Lee's bankability in a lot of ways, is kind of Ang Lee has this interesting almost 1940s cowboy vista vision thing going on, both in this and then later in The Incredible Hulk, the Eric Bana one. And that was part of what tanked The Incredible Hulk, was that the world felt too big. The vision of Wyoming that Ang presents in this film is just almost too intensely wildernessy. It's when you're inside, you're so confined and everything is so tight. And then when you're outside, unless you're getting a close-up on Heath and Jake, they are almost dwarfed by the Wyoming wilderness and all the places they filmed, except for Signal, where they start the movie at, which is not where the novella starts at. Every place but Signal is a real place you can physically go to. This is all physical location. This is all them really on horses, really jumping into a lake from like 50 feet in the air. This is all very real, and it's almost too real. It's almost so real, it's jarring. And it was kind of Aang's trademark a little bit in this almost fantastical version of real, because he'd done it in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, to effect with martial arts films. It's an interesting thing, because by all the metrics of 2005, it shouldn't have worked and succeeded. It's almost too art house, almost too niche. I cannot stress this enough. This was a 3 hour, almost a 3 hour, not a 3 hour, I thought it was a 3 hour movie. It's only charged 14 minutes, but it's for being a something treated from a 13 page novella. It feels like there shouldn't be enough to make a two and some change movie here. Like it feels like it shouldn't be paced the way it is. It feels like it should be a short film, but there is such an incredible length to this film and to the story of the 20 years that Ennis and Jack get together, and kind of the heartbreaking ways they can't talk to each other and the heartbreaking ways they do talk to each other. There's so much in this film that's about the absence of what's there. Interestingly enough, the one thing that I learned that I want to talk about is that Annie Proulx, again, I'm sorry, Annie, I'm butchering your name. I hope if I ever meet you, I can apologize in person. Even in the Wikipedia page for versions of this, because there have been several versions of this after the film that were made, including an opera and a play that happened in the West End last year. It's worth noting that in the Wikipedia entry for this, for the adaptations of Brokeback Mountain especially, Annie talks specifically that she still gets fan fiction from men wanting to quote unquote fix the story. And she's like, look, if you can't fix it, you just have to bear it. And there's something about the honesty of what Annie wrote. She's been accused of having fallen in love with her main characters, which she says she has not. And I think it speaks to this film. But it is an interesting thing that the response to this film is not, the response to this film in its time was not about how do we bear this? How do we move on? How do we take this art and make things better? It was, I'm going to write the story so I can fix what happened. And I think it's an interesting response to this very heartbreaking art piece. Even the side characters in this film are complicit. And my favorite side character that I hadn't realized was in this film until I looked at the cast page was David Harbour, who plays Randall Malone, who's the friend of Jack and Loreen, who Jake and Anne play. So the Malones, who become kind of their best friends for a while, and it's assumed that Jack Twist had an affair with Randall Malone for a while. That's David Harbour and Anna Faris playing opposite of Jake Gyllenhaal and Anne Hathaway. And I just, like, my brain can't compute David Harbour in 2005, because it doesn't feel like he was around then. It feels like he came fully formed into the Stranger Things universe, but that's David Harbour and Anna Faris playing in this movie. Linda Cardellini from Scooby-Doo is in this movie. Randy Quaid, who's unfortunately gone off the deep end a little bit, plays Joe Aguirre, who is the reason Jack and Ennis are sheepherding the first time and then will not rehire. He won't rehire. I think he doesn't rehire Ennis. I think Jack isn't available that year. I can't remember.
And the it specifically was Jack came back to speak to him, and he because he'd seen them playing around, shall we say, on the mountain, he specifically refused to hire Jack and wouldn't give his, Ennis's contact information or anything to him. So I think that's why they lost contact for a few years after that.
Yeah. And Michelle Williams does a really lot of great heavy lifting as Alma, who plays Ennis's wife. And what's really great about this is that you see the absence of language, because there's so many things that Ennis Del Mar doesn't know how to say. And you see it in how it affects not just his relationship with Jack, but also his relationship with Alma. He doesn't dislike Alma. He's just gay, but he doesn't have the language for it. And in 1963 to 1983, we didn't often have that language. And so this is a movie that you can watch if you're a person that likes looking at how people both succeed and fail at code switching, about kind of the absence of things, even at looking how queerness was perceived in the 60s and before, because it wasn't all swinging for all people, you know, it wasn't like an accepted. We have this idea of how accepted things once, even in us fighting for our rights, there was this idea of how do we assimilate versus how do we stand out. And I think Brokeback Mountain is a kind of a great part of story, part of a capsule of history, and it's very brutal. And I wouldn't want the bad things to happen that happened in the film, but I do understand why Annie's like, this is not something to be fixed. This is something to be examined and to be. And to mull over. Like, this is not something you can take scissors to just because you want the happy ending. Yes, we want that. And the fact that it doesn't happen, that's supposed to be that way. And that's something we have to live with. And that's hard.
It is, and I wonder whether it, like, for some people viewing it came from a sense of emotional attachment they developed towards the characters, which in itself is a great accolade to the film. There's so many films and shows and books, etc., that you witness but you never form a connection with. The fact that these people become so invested within the story that they want to fix it. It's a great little gold star to the film, although I wish that they would have some perception that maybe you shouldn't go bothering the author about like your desire to fix the story, because the story doesn't need to be fixed. The story is what it is at the end of the day. It's an examination of this time period, and sadly, the very real struggles that a lot of gay and bisexual men and gay and bisexual women and trans went through in that period out in the rural parts of the States. And that's not to disparage against people that were having similar experiences in urban environments and such, but the story is very specifically about what was probably quite real life experiences for a number of people that they were going through, the struggles to understand their feelings that weren't part of the norm per se, to find a place for themselves. And some people had it better than others, unfortunately, but that's why it was so important to have a story of like this told. And in terms of emotional attachment, it really did strike a chord with a lot of people. When I saw it in the cinema back in 2005, I remember hearing crying all around me. And at one point, I glanced around during a quiet moment in the film. And besides, so it was myself and my gay youth group that had gone to watch it. And everyone else in cinema was various straight friends and straight couples and such. None of the straight couples were not crying together. They were so emotionally distraught by what they were witnessing on the screen. And again, I wonder if that's just a really good sign that of how powerfully emotional this film was, even if the characters themselves struggled with their emotions. You were talking about like absence before.
Oh, yeah.
I think visually as well, the film does a great sense of that, because Brokeback is such a big, imposing environment. I remember one friend of mine commented before he felt that Brokeback was the third main character in the film, since it's such an integral part of the film and the relationship between Jack and Ennis. But it's so vast, but yet it's empty as well. like all this distance, and it almost mirrors the distance that you see between Jack and Ennis sometimes.
I think people, when people watch this film, there's a couple of things I want people to think about. So we're really, it's this is ubiquitous now. It's kind of like it's kind of like Neo dodging bullets in the Matrix. It's very ubiquitous now, and like it's very divorced from its creation. The scene where Jack Twist says, "I wish I knew how to quit you," and they're standing far apart. The camera doesn't really show them much in the same frame at all. Either it's doing like this conversational dialogue thing where you can't see one actor. It doesn't show them together until Ennis is trying to fix what's broken between them. And just the idea of a male character wrestling with their sexuality, who is so upset by what has happened, they've gone to see sex workers in Mexico, which is another great cinematographic thing I want to talk about. But just the fights they have are so powerful, and the phrase "I don't know how to quit you" became so ubiquitous to the American lexicon in a way. But its origins in this film, in this moment, in nearly the middle of the film, is probably one of the most heartbreaking things a person could say and could feel. Because, and I cannot stress this enough, and I need people to understand this about queer cinema, it has been a long time where being gay was an accepted thing. Like, I need you to understand, when someone says something like that, there is a tradition in queerness of people really feeling that and wishing they could be not other. And I think when people hear this podcast, and we do stuff where we're talking about aesthetic and things like that, this is the sort of movie that strips that artifice out and really does focus on almost the history of the struggle of the love that dare not speak its name. Oscar Wilde went to jail because he liked sucking dick. I can't stress this enough. It's not something that we've been able to be safe in doing for a long time. And even now, people are trying to still roll back rights and throw us back in the closet. And it's so impactful. And I do wish that it had been a happy ending for myself. And I'm very selfish about that. I do like the fact, and here's where I'm talking about the cinema part of it for a moment. I really like the use of, it's not a flashback, I don't actually know what the term for it is, but that really awful scene close to the end. And I guess this is probably where I should figure out what I want for trigger warnings for this, because there do need to be some trigger warnings for this film. Especially for the scene I'm going to be talking about, the scene where Ennis is talking to Lurleen, I think Lurleen is her name,
I believe
the
so,
Anne
yes.
Hathaway character,
Jack's girl.
and she is monotone talking about how Jack died, but that is not the vision that Ennis has, and the vision that Ennis has is also the reason that he can't talk to himself about his homosexuality, and he can't, like, it's so good because it's not a flashback, but it's so important both to the character and the moment. It's a great use of cinema in exploring another time and space while something else is going on. Anne Hathaway's, I still get chills when I think about Anne Hathaway's monotone, tired recitation of what happened to her husband. And it mirrors a moment that's missing from the New York Times version of the book that I think is in the expanded edition, and I think that they put into the play that Lucas Hedges did in the West End, where he played Jack, I think. And there's this idea of flashback and flash forward that happens throughout the film, and there's supposed to be like an opening scene, which is Ennis waking up much later and having a flashback to talk about Jack and remembering Jack. And I kind of wish that had been in the film. I understand why it wasn't. But there's just the cinema of this film and the heartbreak of it. And I don't want to call it unease, but there's something very important about queer films like this where there is a frank unease and a remembrance of when things weren't good. And it's heartbreaking, but it has to, it kind of has to be. I mean, it kind of has to be honest about the struggle of sexuality in a world where sexuality, straight or gay, is taboo, but being gay is even more taboo when it's punished. And so it's a visually beautiful film, but it's just heartbreaking in so many ways. I don't know who else could have directed this. I can't think of anyone but Ang Lee doing something like this, even with such, even if he was a little displaced from it, with such a deft hand. You see his work in Crouching Tiger in it. You see a little bit of what we're going to get in Life of Pi, which he did in 2012. You don't see as much. So my favorite Ang Lee film, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman from 1994, you don't see as much of that in this. But if you watch Eat, Drink, Man, Woman and look at how spacing works and how claustrophobic the inner city feels, you can understand why in a rural area he took Wyoming and he made it so big and vast and incomprehensible, which is, by the way, what most of America is like. Most of America is vast and incomprehensible. And I know that we're trying to pave everywhere to put up a parking lot instead of paradise, but like there are parts of the country where it's just miles upon miles of nothing but like golden grass and mountains and not rivers so much anymore with climate change, but in 2005 we still had, you know, rivers and ponds of the size they jumped into. That could also be something good to talk about. There's lots of use of body in this film, which is really neat. It's almost intimate, but not. It pulls away from the intimacy in a lot of ways, which is something I thought about when we decided to talk about it, because you feel like it's an intimate film. But if you think about it and how they show body, when they show Lurleen and Jack in the truck and you get Anne Hathaway's, a shot of Anne Hathaway's boobs, her body is cut off and you never see Jack's reaction. Ennis and Alma in bed is never really seen. Jack and Ennis in the tent is all in shadow. And you get body, but it's in shadow. The faraway shot where we see Jack and Ennis stripped down to jump into the lake, they're far away. But even though the internet in 2005 wasn't as prodigious as it is now, people screen capped the hell out of that. So there's something very alienating about it, even in close up, even in the bodies. The use of the 4th of July fireworks to go with Jack and Lurleen having sex is kind of interesting because I can never tell if that's supposed to be whimsical or heartbreaking or what it is. I like the ambiguity. I like not knowing if Randall and Jack actually hooked up. You know, I like the ambiguity and the alienation and the heartbreak to this film. It's such an effective thing that is very ballsy to do because that's not big Hollywood. Hollywood kind of hates when you do the kind of alienation thing, like it's a Moonrise Kingdom, Little Miss Sunshine thing, and they're like, this is indie, because a big blockbuster is not supposed to be this way. It's supposed to resolve. There's supposed to be catharsis. Brokeback doesn't really give you that. It makes you want to fix it. It makes things very difficult. You have to examine things, cry on your popcorn, you know.
Yes. It leaves you distraught. It leaves you, in a way, empty. Because of the, you know, as you say, there's no like satisfying conclusion to this story. It's a tale of what these poor men have gone through and the events of their lives over these 20 years. And I think maybe that's why quite a few people felt almost, you see, I know how. The word I want to use to describe how they felt. I don't personally feel this way, but they would have felt cheated by the fact that they didn't get their conclusion. They didn't get Jack and Ennis together. They didn't get whatever they imagined would happen and such. They wouldn't, instead, like the story told itself and it just leaves them feeling distraught by that. I agree with you, like there's a lot of implications in the way the filmography is. It, in a sense, the actual use of body in the film thinking about it, we get more acts of like either abrupt passion or actual violence against each other rather than clear signs of intimacy. Like the aggressive, sudden, passionate kiss that Jack and Ennis have after returning, like meeting up after 4 years again together. There's that. But then they have the physical brawl with each other that leaves them both bloody. That's the most physical activity they have with one another that's actually explicitly shown. And so it's almost in a sense that the internal frustration that they're both feeling towards each other and towards their own feelings is almost carried across in a physical way, and it's shown there. And perhaps that's a great way to encapsulate how there's this miscommunication and almost a constant sense of misunderstanding between them, that they can never quite fall in sync with each other over what they both want with each other.
Yeah. I can see that. It's also interesting too, in that in this film, when people aren't talking, they're either being violent or overly polite. Ennis doesn't intend to hurt Alma in a lot of the film, but he does. He hurts her several times in several ways, not necessarily physically. But then there's that big knockout fight that happens in the kitchen.
Yeah.
There's the implied violence. The implied violence at the end, not of what happened to Jack, but Jack's father's reaction of Ennis trying to make things right, because Jack had asked Ennis to open up a ranch with him, which was about as close to marriage proposal as one can get, I suppose. the indignity of Jack's father controlling his son's ashes and deciding his final resting place, and that heartbreaking, the heartbreaking end that everyone kind of remembers with Heath Ledger opening up the closet and saying the shirt within a shirt, that has a partner in some versions of the expanded novella, where that's also the opening of the story and the opening of the remembrance. And I think that in itself is exquisitely painful in a lot of ways. And it really does talk about the language of silence in this film. Which is very hard to do on film, because people, especially in America, expect a lot of language in our movies. Silence is not something we're incredibly comfortable with.
I suppose something else to take from it is, this is a film where there's a lot of things that are unsaid, but come across within sort of the scene, in the scenery and the essence of the scene. Certain thing, like, you can tell what the characters would love to say to each other if they felt the freedom to do so, the freedom to give themselves a chance to speak properly. The things left unsaid, the implications of what they would like to say to each other, or the frustration they feel towards one another. In the end, I suppose the silence is really all they have then to give each other. And that just becomes then another facet of the sort of the heartbreak that both this couple and unfortunately the people around them go through, because, you know, the impact of Jack and Ennis's inability to form a relationship, it has some impacts on all of those people involved with them. To be honest, Ennis's daughter seems to have come across as quite well adjusted, considering everything that happened.
Well, and there's some inference there in that she might kind of understand her father. Some of the people that fix it explicitly make her queer so she can help him open up, but I don't like reading that in. I think one of the things that's really important to think about when you think about Brokeback Mountain, not necessarily in its queerness, although I think it does have some of that too, is that foreign-born directors are always better at portraying the Wild West consistently than American directors are. A lot of the cowboy movies that people love, the Clint Eastwood ones, some of the John, I don't know if the John Wayne ones, those were all MGM, I think. But at least the Clint Eastwood ones, almost all were exclusively made by Italian directors. And so there's actually this interesting duality in how America is showcased, especially the rural parts. It's sort of changing. Like, we have movies like Red Rocket, where it feels like the rural thing is starting to come back to a homegrown feel. So for a long time, it was really Italians that were doing the myth of the Wild West in a lot of ways. And then we get to the Wild West on TV. So the reason I bring this up, because we go from film cowboys, and we get no cowboys for a while, except a couple of musicals. Larry McMurtry, who was a screenwriter on Brokeback, wrote the Lonesome Dove novels, which became a very famous late 80s, early 90s TV miniseries with Tommy Lee Jones. One of the highest rated miniseries in all of American cable. It got like 26 million in 1989, which is insane. No cowboy, no Western miniseries since has been able to reproduce it, that I can tell. So there's kind of this ease of comfort with what West, rural, and wilderness means in a way in America, because Lonesome Dove transitions into like Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and things like that. Now, these are all kind of straight and sanitized. I haven't read the Lonesome Dove books, but as much as I remember the miniseries, it's pretty damn straight. For a long time, cowboy stuff went out again, because cowboy stuff comes in and out. All this interesting resurgence after Brokeback of pairing cowboy with other things. And now we're to a place where cowboy is back, because I have people in college that really love things like Yellowstone. And so we're seeing this return to the wilderness. We've got like Pioneer Woman doing stupid stuff on the Food Network because she's an awful person. But then we've got this new thing where we're doing, where you can see it in, what's the movie that, it's called Nope or something like that. It was like an alien epic.
Yes. It was called Nope.
Yeah, it was one of the Jordan Peele films, right? I think I got that right, yeah. So it
was.
Yeah, so we start seeing Neo-Western paired with Alien. We get to Outer Banks, the show which I watched and wanted to love, but I didn't understand, which pairs cowboy with Greek mythology. The way that Ang Lee pairs the cowboy mythology, the cowboy mystique, this rough, rugged, silent, stoic Marlboro man kind of character that Ennis is supposed to represent, and the taboo character that Jack represents, and how they both move through the world, it's almost like you're pairing cowboy, not with a foreign film, but pairing cowboy with an earlier version of what cowboy's supposed to be. It's almost like Ennis wants to be a sort of silent John Wayne type, and Jack is flipping that Clint Eastwood character on its head. There's something very kind of gunsmoky about it, but there's something very much where it's a very approachable film in some ways, and it understands the American iconography of the West as seen through a foreign lens. I don't know in actuality if this is true, but as I understand it, the mythology of the West, because it doesn't exist anywhere else, it's kind of this interestingly loved European ideal both in France and Italy. And so the card game Bang is Italian, and the version of the Haunted Mansion in Disneyland Paris is based upon Western mythology, specifically because of this purported love of the American West in Europe.
Oh,
that is That is what I have read, and I have been told by several people that I have reiterated. I have no idea if it's true. That's what I've been told.
This is news to me, but then I cannot claim to have an in-depth knowledge of every sort of
Know it all.
passing interest of the French and Italian peoples.
You're doing werewolf stuff right now, anyway, so
Yeah.
I never time
Ooh,
it.
cowboys versus werewolves.
Cowboys versus Wolves. I think also, and no one's ever asked him about this, but I would be curious. At least I've never seen anyone ask about this. I would be curious to know if Orville Peck's not aesthetic, but his music is influenced by Brokeback. Because I know that his work is really deep into Western. Like he loves Western mythology. He's not American born, so he comes at it again as kind of this foreign person that fell in love with the with folk music and a very niche sort of country western. But I can't imagine that Orville Peck has not seen Brokeback Mountain. But no one's ever asked him about it, and I do wonder if because he wasn't tasked to do the music for either the play from the West End or the opera. But I do wonder how much of Brokeback influenced Orville Peck's idea of romance. I could honestly see like Curse of the Black and Die potentially being a song that's an ode to Brokeback. I'm a big fan of Orville. I think Orville's work is really interesting in what it does aesthetically. I think kind of this glam rock neo country thing is really cool and different. It's also his work does give me some Brokeback vibes or something very dark and alienated about it, and it's liberating, but it's also some of his songs are very deep and difficult. And there's something very Brokeback about Orville's work in a way. Yeah. So it's one of those things where when we think about Brokeback Mountain, its queerness sets it apart, but American viewings of cowboy mythology as seen through a foreign lens was not new. So it wasn't necessarily a reskin. The setting in Wyoming is kind of new. Wyoming's not usually a place where you set the sort of thing. But I really liked the use of Wyoming, because really the only other time we see in a mainstream film was I think they're in South Dakota is in, I think it's Vertigo, where Hitchcock has the big fight on Mount Rushmore. So it's not, or maybe it's North by Northwest, I can't remember. But so it's kind of unusual to use Wyoming as like a rural Western representation, but it works really well. The vastness of it works because it's still kind of green, which I like. It's not completely barren, it's not completely, the desert. There's still some green and things that thrive in spite of how alienated it is. And I think it's probably part of the message too, I would say.
Yeah, like the sheep.
Yes, the sheep. That's why they're there. They're sheep herders. Something interesting too is when you look at cowboy mythology, generally it's a person transitions into being a sheriff or something like that. That was kind of the first big cowboy movie, High Noon, which was famously made in real time. Like there's no time editing in it. It's real time. It's absolute insanity. Normally in a cowboy movie, people transition. Like if you think about like Tombstone, where someone transitions, support your local sheriff, Blazing Saddles. It's normally about the construct of the Western town. It's not about someone be stepping into a role and becoming a bigger part of the community or trying. This movie is more about the futility of trying to get through life. Ennis and Jack never really get to achieve a higher ideal than longing for each other. Like they want to, they try. Jack works for his father-in-law. Ennis does his best to be a father and to make a living doing what he knows, but neither of them fulfill any sort of actual cowboy trope. And they're always cut off from having that same experience as they had the first time, whether it's by Randy Quaid's character or by Michelle Williams' character and and as having the responsibility of having children. They never are able to recreate that first magical. It's very much Mamma Mia. You can never recreate the magic, you know, later on. Anyway. It all comes back to Mamma Mia. Maybe that should be the name of the podcast. It all comes back to Mamma Mia, you know, at some point.
True. Well, maybe we could do like a special one-off renaming episode if we found something that really had a strong connection to the good old Mamma Mia.
Yes. Well, I'm also just being a little silly because, to be perfectly frank, the movie is a bit of a downer. Normally when I talk about queer cinema, I want to do more uplifting. I try not to do too much. But we have to acknowledge a lot of queer cinema is about longing, and a lot of queer cinema in the olden days did not. And if you've ever seen either versions of Boys in the Band, that's going to ruin your day. Because, like, no one ends happy in that. Fortune in men's eyes, everyone's in jail at the end of it. It's not queer cinema getting a happy ending is such, it's such a new and still kind of somewhat revolutionary thing. I don't think about it, but the reality is when we talk about queer cinema, so often it's that unfulfilled narrative.
Yeah. I want to touch upon modern queer cinema and LGBT creations in a moment. But actually thinking about it, I just made this connection in my head. So it was an unfortunate older trope about, you know, LGBT characters could never have a happy ending. And that was a sort of running, and I don't want to say lore or a running sort of theme. It was what was demanded by the studios and by sort of the publishers and such in general. You can't show LGBT people being happy and getting a happy ending. That, you know, you have to show them meeting a sticky end. And that was something that happened for far too long. In a way, you do see it happen within this film. But the crucial difference is that this is a story sort of where we're capturing control of the narrative. And the reason why, you know, the story is what it is because we're the ones telling the story and we want to show like what it was during that time as experiences for many people. So yes, whilst it's still in a way follows a lot of the theming from the older decades in the sense of like your gays can't be happy and have happy endings, there's a crucial difference in the fact that this is very much a queer film that was made for the purpose of telling that story and telling it in a way that's not disparaging the characters. You know, the reason that they end up unhappy is sadly that's just what that time was like for many people. And so, yes, it is an incredibly tough film to watch, but it wouldn't be Brokeback Mountain if it wasn't the story as it is at the end of the day. And we touched upon how it influenced cowboy films and series. I just want to quickly ask you, do you think it's influenced modern LGBT television as well?
I think people probably go and think about it. I mean, I can count on my hand the number of times like Family Guy has referenced it for a joke. I don't know how much TV is doing it. I think Outer Banks might have played with it a little bit, but not very much. There was quite a bit of homoeroticism in Outer Banks in a lot of ways. When I think about like Yellowstone, I don't really think of queer characters. It's so much about survival. I don't think that anyone has asked anyone recently if Brokeback is like one of their things that has Like, I could see if you think about a superhero film in that context, maybe one of the Punisher films could potentially fit that if you find the wilderness to be like an inner city narrative. I think it's tough because now we're just far enough removed because we're going to come up on like the 20-year anniversary of it next year, right? So we're just now far enough removed that it's so ubiquitous. It's like asking someone again if they were influenced by the Matrix. They probably were, but they may not register it necessarily. I do
True.
think our generation specifically is heavily influenced by nostalgia for this film. And I think that's something to kind of register in that people may not know work they're creating is influenced by Brokeback just because it's something they treasure so much. It's in there, no matter what. I do think I would say probably for the people who were in this film and who were part of the production, there's no way it didn't have an impact. I honestly say probably Anne Hathaway and Jake Gyllenhaal, this did boost their career in quite a visible way. I'm still puzzled that it's David Harbour because I did not remember it was David Harbour. Like I watched the movie and I was like, that can't be David Harbour.
This has been a revelation.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I would assume he feels pretty good about being in the movie because it doesn't seem like he would like downplay it. He was in it. I don't know when was the last time someone asked Jake Gyllenhaal about Brokeback. I assume if the anniversary is coming up next year, which I can't believe it's 2024, so I'm saying next year for that. But I assume there'll be a resurgence. Maybe there'll be like a DVD special where they'll talk about like how Brokeback has influenced things after. Because it's something I can't anticipate. And cowboy isn't my normal genre. So it's so hard for me to be like,
It
yes, and to
isn't.
this, you know? Yeah, just because I've seen Oklahoma doesn't mean cowboy is my genre. I do think in so much as Supernatural was sort of about folk tales, which has a mythological spin. I could see Dean Winchester have being influenced by Ennis, but I don't know if I want to give that much credit. I think it just so happens that Dean Winchester has a lot of Ennis in him. But that's an interesting idea because they did a lot of callback to wilderness and cowboy culture with Dean in later seasons. So, I mean, ultimately, if I had to say, probably Supernatural is the heaviest one. But they really went in on the cowboy thing when they decided that was Dean's personality for that part of the show. So it's hard to say. Yeah.
I suppose a just to bring up a quick last point from my side of things. I suppose if anything, looking at LGBT television, for example, nowadays, and filmmaking, whilst there is still very much dramatic films and there's real life gritty films as well, there's been a massive swing towards more positive and life affirming theming. And it's a sort of shows that have been really seized upon. Like, for example, Heartstopper, Red, White, and Royal Blue, to go the slightly dramatic sort of end, Elite and Young Royals and such. Like, they all have their issues and problems, but it's sort of gone in a different direction now. And I wonder if it's just the sort of speed that you've seen queer filmmaking taking that's gone in a different direction since the time that Brokeback came out.
And I think part of it too is that in pop culture, there's almost more permissiveness in. So we talked about Elite, we talked about Gossip Girl. I'd even throw Revenge in there. Often, so often it feels like that queerness is reserved for the upper class in pop culture, outside of, say, Shameless, as the newest property to do it. I can't think of that many blue collar queer characters, maybe in The Wire. I know there's one off character in The Soprano that was revealed to be queer.
What
But
about?
there's about it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which we haven't talked about, and I've been meaning to get on our list for a while now. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is the only show that actively outs and then takes back the queerness from one of their main characters. And it feels like a very pointed critique of how queerness is portrayed as always this upper class moneyed thing that people are allowed to do. There's not a lot of outside of Shameless yet again that I can think of, and I could be totally wrong, because again, there's so many TV, there's so many different streaming services. I always am missing something, I feel like. It often feels like when we talk about queer characters that are explicitly out there, mostly they're upper class, rich, and they can afford the decadence of being gay in a lot of ways. Or they live with a family that accepts them, so they don't like they like if they go to high school or something like that. When I think about lower class, like queerness and people that are economically struggling but still come out, Shameless is the only one I can think of off the top of my head. And that's kind of a problem. And that's something Shameless and Brokeback share, is that Brokeback is not a movie about people that have made it and have no money struggles. Even for Jack, the male character, the lead that's supposed to have quote unquote made it, there's still struggles because he's living in the shadow of his father-in-law's company. His wife is arguably the more successful, but he's also he spends his almost his entire life brokenhearted over Ennis, which, to be fair, I've seen Heath Ledger, so I understand. But it's one of those things where, and I don't know if this has been different in British TV or if there's more of it in your dramas, because you have a lot of like period dramas, and quite famously, Downton Abbey had an openly queer character. I think that was the character, what's his
The
name later in,
butler.
yeah, the butler in Downton Abbey. So there's that, but mostly it feels like it's not reserved for the more rugged, quote unquote, lower class characters. It feels very upper
I
class,
would,
this. It feels very posh, very Euphoria-ish, kind of thing.
God's Own Country, that was about a pair of farmers and such, and
Oh
in a
yeah, I
way it
think
was
that's,
those
is
two
that
because
Australian or what's that British? I can't remember.
it's
I don't know.
British.
Okay.
During the actual promotion of the film, journalists often quoted it as the British Brokeback. So there you go, there's an
No,
influence there for
yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah.
you.
So I really liked today's episode and the work, because we often do stuff that is straight and we queer code it, but taking something queer and looking at its history is really important. Because, and again, I cannot stress this enough, 2005 was only nearly 20 years ago, and this was a taboo movie then. This was kind of a rule-breaking thing. This changed the trajectory of several careers. It is a heartbreaking film. It's not a film you come out of feeling better about being queer necessarily. But it's so important to tell this history. Wyoming is also the place where we lost Matthew Shepard. That's one thing too. It's one thing to think about, is that these stories are very real for a lot of people. That's part of the crying in theater. That's part of the kind of crying as catharsis. So, as much as it kind of sucks to do, it's good to be able to acknowledge these stories and give it context and give it space in kind of the history of American cinema as well, and be like, this was, the stepping stone, the next thing that the cowboy narrative was going to do in critiquing masculinity and critiquing the harm of alienation and not being able to talk, of looking at the idea of rural and Western and saying, hey, this kind of thing did happen, and we're going to look at it for good or for ill. It's a very important movie. It really is. And that's just is, if you haven't seen it or it's been a while, it might be time to pop it in. Maybe if you're having, maybe not if you're having like the worst day you've ever had. Maybe on like a medium day. So you don't bum yourself out or like make things worse. But like it's really important to think about queer films in the context of cinema, of where we are in that time, 2005 wasn't that long ago, and like it's like the fight for marriage equality. It wasn't that long ago. You know, we take for granted now seeing drag queens on streaming services all the time. RuPaul's Drag Race started 4 years after this movie came out in 2009. Like, it's still not even a footnote in the history of things. Like, I just can't express this enough. When we talk about stuff from 2005, it seems like it's been around forever, only the blip of an eye. And it's such important work to be able to shine a light on. So, yeah.
Yes. Oh, wow. I think you nicely summed up all my thoughts on that as well.
Oh, good. Well,
So,
I'm here to help however I can. Yes.
well, it's been a pleasure discussing this with you today, dear sir.
Yes.
And hopefully next time we'll have something that's not too dark as this one.
No, there's always a bit of darkness when we talk about things like lo romance and star-crossed lovers, because that's how drama works. If you're not
Yes.
physically moving someone in a room, you have to emotionally move them in a room. So there's always going to be that. But yeah, it was in Brokeback, it's very important to acknowledge the darkness in it, because that's the only way you get to the light, is by acknowledging the darkness. If you ignore it, it just gets worse.
Yes.
But I'm so happy to start season three with you and to have another year to do pop culture stuff and to talk about when everything truly is gay, even the straight stuff. We'll see you all, hear you all, however this works, however the internet works.
Yes.
Next time, for everyone listening, thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you. We're trying out Thursdays instead of Tuesdays, so that's the other part of it. But we're trying out a new day to see if people like getting an episode on Thursdays instead of Tuesdays better. But yeah, so we'll see you in 2 Thursdays with more of Everything Is Gay, Even the Straight Stuff. Have a great night, everybody.
Bye.